Wayne and Marcia Buskey, Distinguished Fellow in History here at Hillsdale College, where he teaches a variety of classes every fall semester. His Hillsdale teaching has included courses on a wide variety of topics from the ancient world to the present. He's taught courses on the Second World War, classical culture, military history and leadership, and this semester he's teaching a new course on the history of citizenship. Dr. Hansen is also the Martin and Illy Anderson Senior Fellow in Residence in Classics and Military History at the Hoover Institution of Stanford University, where he is also a faculty member and where years ago he earned the PhD in Classics. A prolific author, Professor Hansen is nationally syndicated columnist and the author of hundreds of articles, reviews, papers, essays, editorials on topics that range from contemporary politics to ancient Greek military history, from foreign affairs to the practice and policy of agriculture. But he doesn't just write about such things as farming. Dr. Hansen has spent years as a farmer, living in California's Central Valley in the house his family has occupied for five generations. He knows how to care for orchards and vineyards, not just how to write about them. Yet he is known more for his writing than for his almonds and raisins. He has written over 24 books. I will not read all their titles, but a few of them: The Western Way of War, Mexifornia, A State of Becoming, Carnage and Culture, The Two World Wars, Fields Without Dreams, Defending the Agrarian Idea. His newest, still unpublished book, which I've been happily reading in a draft manuscript form that he shared with me, is titled The Dying Citizen: How Americans Are Becoming Something Else in the Time of Plague, Panic, and Protest. This evening, recognizing that today marks the 75th anniversary of the end of the Second World War, yes, 75 years ago today on the USS Missouri, the Japanese surrendered. That was a war that revealed the sacrifice and patriotism of so many American citizens. It seems fitting, therefore, to consider what American citizens are becoming, if they are indeed becoming something else. So please join me in welcoming Hillsdale's friend and a most valued colleague, Victor Davis Hansen.
Not a good start. Do I need that? I don't think so. Everybody says that each election is the most important in their history, but I think this election is one of the four or five most important. Surely if Lincoln had not been elected in 1860, we would have a different history. Had he not been reelected, they didn't have polls in 1864, but until Sherman took Atlanta on this day in 1864, I think George McClellan would have won the election, and he would have not had an unconditional surrender, and there would have been a bifurcation of the United States. I wasn't a big fan of Franklin Roosevelt, but you could argue had he not been elected in 1940, the Vinson Naval Rearmament Acts and a lot of the rearmament that was very crucial within the next year or two might not have been as steady. But this election, I don't think any longer is about Trump's tweet or Biden's senility. It's not about progressivism versus conservatism. It's about civilization versus anarchy. And nobody in their right mind ever thought a wheeler-dealer Manhattan raconteur would be all between you and what you see with the iconoclast and the statue toppling. They're trying to remove now, apparently, Washington Monument, renaming all of these hallowed names in American history. But that's what it is. And so I'd like to just review what we could expect in the next 65 days. The polls are all over the place, but I think there are polls and there are polls, and the best adjudicator of them is how they did in 2016. And the polls that have Trump in terms of popularity down by 10, you know what I'm talking about, Reuters and Politico, they're never, I mean, he can win by a landslide and the poll the next day say, well, he was down 20. It's just, these are the people who gave us Russian collusion. So I don't think, there are polls that were pretty good. The Zogby poll, no fan of Trump, was pretty good in 2016. Rasmussen's a daily poll. It's a little different. They get a pre-selected audience and they stick with them day by day. They don't have to go out and sample each week. The Emerson poll is pretty good. They all have Trump in terms of favorability within one or two, depending on the week. And in terms of Biden versus Trump, 3 to 4. They're in the margin of errors. But they don't matter because we're not a direct election nation. It's the Electoral College that matters. And if you go back and look at 2016, the polls were some of them were pretty accurate. They said Hillary would win the popular vote by 3 to 5%. She won roughly by 3%. But where they really were inaccurate were the state polls. They had Hillary winning all of the so-called blue wall states. You look at those polls today, and some of them, even though they were maybe identified as conservative, like the Trafalgar poll, shows Trump within 2 points in Minnesota. And most of the Pennsylvania, Michigan, Ohio, North Carolina, Florida polls, are pretty close, if not in some cases Trump ahead. CNN polled all of what they called were the 11 swing states, and Trump was within about 1 point of Biden. So what's happening is this race is tightening up. And as I mentioned to someone at dinner, the way to look at this thing is, if I could use a metaphor, is Trump is the captain, the campaign is a ship, the port is election day. He's got to get there. And the sails are his election and campaigning strategy. And he's had headwinds because the commander-in-chief is blamed for the greatest plague since 1918 in the United States. He's blamed for the first quarantine that we've had on a national basis, the recession, the George Floyd. And then the winds are starting to change because it seems that in terms of the virus, the lockdown, the violence, they're being recalibrated in the voters' mind. And so Trump, as the captain, can't get up on the mast and take a knife and cut holes in his sail and let those tailwinds go through. And that's a metaphor for what? Tweeting about Joe Scarborough or Jeff Sessions or that dirty dog Hillary, as he says. So that's not wise. And you can see that his team has been more disciplined, though they're saying to him, we're on a trajectory of insidious, incremental change in people's attitudes given the violence and these issues. And I'm going to go through them very quickly. And you can't disrupt that tailwind. And he's been pretty much far more disciplined. People that are on his team that are the more disciplined and the more sober and judicious, I'm talking about Mike Pompeo or Attorney General Barr or Ben Carson, they're taking a greater role. And it presents a more professional team than Scaramucci or Omarosso or all the rest of them. And that's helped him. And you can start to pick up little senses. Something's going on, and you can look at sales of real estate in downtown major cities, people are leaving. You can see gun sales are at a record level. You can see the NBA viewership is at a record low. So you get the impression that people, they're anxious and they're going to do something, but they don't want to talk about it. And what that something is, I think I'd like to go through now. If you look at the main issue of our time, it's COVID-19, and it doesn't really matter. You can go back and forth that Trump had a travel ban, Biden criticized it. Trump said it was like a bad flu, but then Nancy Pelosi invited people to come into Chinatown right during the worst beginning of it. You can go back and forth. The fact is that if you look at the number of dead per million in the United States and you compare them with the UK, Spain, Italy, France is catching up again. We were better than France, and Germany is an outlier. It's pretty good, but we're doing about what Europe does, or a little better. And we have a lot more challenges, I think, in some ways than Europe does. But my point is, that doesn't matter. The commander-in-chief, whether it's Katrina or the Iraq War, whether it goes bad or good, the person gets the blame, as you know, in recessions and depression. And so everybody blamed Trump, and he was reduced to Typhoid Mary. But we're in the second spike now, and cases have gone down for 32 straight days. We don't know. This virus is like a, you know, it's like a torpedo that's taken off on its own course. You have no idea what it's going to do at any given time. But the point is that people are getting the impression that whatever happened in the past, we're getting to closer to a vaccine, the treatments are getting better, and maybe the virus itself is bumping into more people. 6 million people have had it, and people suggest maybe 60 million have had antibodies and don't even know it, or they have T cells. So we're getting not to herd immunity, but to areas where it's not going to be as infected, and that will help the incumbent. That's a tailwind in the next 60 days. And the recession. This is the first time in my memory the United States has had a self-induced recession. It's taken one of the most vibrant and dynamic economies in its history, and it's deliberately shut it down for logical purposes, but nevertheless it was self-induced. That's important to remember, because there was not a structural flaw in the economy. There wasn't a run on the banks. There wasn't a property bubble. And that suggests that it can come back, and it can even come back with a roar if people have pent-up demand. And you're starting to see a little bit of that already. And I think that will continue to get better. So that's an issue that I think would help Trump. The lockdown obviously hurt him, whether even though it was up to the individual states. But the lockdown is starting to be recalibrated, not whether we're going to stay in our house all day long, but whether 50 million children can't go back to school. 50 million children that have about 1 in 5,000 chances of being seriously ill from this virus, unlike the rest of us, which is probably about 1 to 5 in 100, depending on our age and comorbidity. But what I'm getting at is that a lot of parents feel that they're going crazy with their kids in the house, and they can't really get back to work fully if they have to babysit. And that issue favors a candidate that says, let's go do it. Let's get back, open the school. That can change. You could have another third wave. Plagues, it seems, don't have third waves in their first year, but it could happen. But that favors Trump as well. The big thing, though, the issue right now is the aftermath of the George Floyd killing. And if you look at the rating of BLM after Floyd's killing death, however you want to characterize it, on the 25th of May, by June 10th, about 70% of Americans were not really aware of the Marxist origins of BLM, but they were favorable. That's now below 50%. It's taken a great dive. In other words, when people look at the Million Dollar Mile being looted, or Santa Monica's downtown being trashed, or people trying to roast policemen alive in their precinct in Portland, they don't see signs with George Floyd, we're doing this. It's now a Antifa BLM riot. And there's no sympathy, and that's across the racial, ethnic, gender spectrum. And it's just a question of how the president handles it. Seems to me that it's been pretty wise. He's taken the Lincoln approach of 1860-61, saying, I'm not going to go down in the South and precipitate the Civil War, but I am going to protect Fort Sumner or Federal Armory or my property. Trump said something that was really interesting. He said, Gavin Newsom doesn't run Yosemite. That's our federal property. And we can tell you to go in to Yosemite, not him. And being selective like that is very wise, because it puts the onus on the local person for the violence, but yet it shows that he's concerned. At the same time, the Attorney General is looking for federal indictments. And you can see that there is a profile of the Antifa, to take one example, protester. This is not a revolutionary Che Guevara who wants to go up in the mountains with an AR-15 and attack you. This is a high school teacher, social worker, student who's scared to death to get a felony on his record, because every time he gets arrested, I'm being metaphorical, or he's attacked, he almost goes into a fetal position and starts crying, stop there, or when he's attacked by a counter-protester, where's the police? So you get the impression that this is a product of a lack of deterrence. And when the AG starts to indict people with serious federal consequences, and it won't be up to a local prosecutor to drop the charges, I think that also will win approval and will be effective. Let me just pause for a minute and suggest that these are not my impressions. These are impressions that we know in ways that even trump the narrowing in the polls. Remember, pollsters like Reuters or New York Times, they have political agendas, and they can warp those polls by phrasing the question a particular way or choosing either registered voters or all residents or likely voters, and that will leverage or warp the result. And that's not counting the woke people who actually tabulated. Who knows what they do? But there's some polls that can't be warped, and those are the internal polls. All of you, if you've gone to a surgeon or oncologist, you don't pay him good money for him to lie to you and say you don't have cancer when you do. That's what an internal pollster is. You pay him money, he gets in a quiet room, he closes the door, and he says, look, you are going to lose Michigan if you don't, and that's what's happening. And that's reflected when Nancy Pelosi says, I think we should cancel the debate. Hillary Clinton says, I think he should never concede if he loses. Don Lemon on CNN says, I think it's time to talk about the violence. Michelle Obama and Barack Obama said, you got to vote, got to go, vote, 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 vote. Everybody's good. That shows you that they are reacting to an internal, accurate poll. They paid good money that shows the race is probably within the margin of error. Another is Vegas bettors. Bettors don't have any ideology. Their ideology, they worship money. And if you looked at what it was 3 or 4 weeks ago, 80% of the bets were on Biden, and Biden, not to use the better terminology, but in a layman's term, was about a 60-40 preference of the bettors. They thought that's what's going to happen. Now it's dead even. And over 80% of the bets are going on Trump. And that shows you that people who are not political and they don't really care who wins, but they want to give accurate information because they're getting paid to do it, have seen something. And it's these change in these issues. Another is the VP selection. I can't think in my memory a vice president ever, a presidential candidate who was a certain nominee said in advance the gender of his running mate. He did. And I think he thought it might be Elizabeth Warren. But then he didn't anticipate the George Floyd. And pretty soon he was told that it would be African American. So then there's African American women, and there are no governors. And there's only maybe 2 senators. I think Tammy Duckworth has some African-American ancestry, but it was really Kamala Harris. The rest of the people had not been vetted. We don't really get mayors as vice president. It's very rare to have a House representative. And Kamala Harris had only got 2% of the vote. And she was a very controversial upper-middle-class person whose parents were both PhDs, masquerading as sort of an inner-city child. And she'd accused Joe Biden of being a racist in the, basically de facto in the race. So she was an off-putting person, and there was a reason why she exited the race at 2% popularity. And those traits, I think, are already starting to resurface. So that was not a wise selection. Then there's the Biden paradox. Trump is not careful when he makes fun of the cognitive limitations of what he calls sleepy Joe Biden. The thing about these epithets, I saw some of you laugh. I'd always play a trick on my daughter who was very critical of Trump. And so I'll always say, I hate these epithets too, Polly. I really hate little Marco and crooked Hillary and low energy Jeb, and I see her start laughing. And when she starts laughing, it hits a nerve because she's told me it's not nice to do that, yet she's laughing. And I think that was the key to the cunning of Trump, that he has ability to identify a weakness and to exploit it in a very cruel but often real way. And the problem with Biden is that sticks. He's not cognitively as a person. It's not a matter of age. There's people 90, 95, they're far more hale than he is. But what I'm getting at is, what do you do when you know your candidate is not going to perform? I've used a metaphor before, but when Winston Churchill was first Lord of the Admiralty, he said a very funny thing. They were boycotting the Kaiser's Germany and running a sea embargo. It was critical, and they stopped any German ships from coming near Britain. And it was very important to supply the troops at the Somme in Belgium and France from England. And had the U-boats or German destroyers interrupted that, they would have lost the war. And Admiral Jellicoe, and so somebody's mentioned Jellicoe, and Churchill said, he's the only man that can lose the war in the afternoon. Joe Biden is the only candidate in U.S. history that can lose the election in 5 seconds if they let him out. He can say, at any given time, he can say almost anything. He says, you ain't black one more time, and that poll today that said 25% of African Americans will soar. He says to a African American journalist, it'd be like me calling you a junkie or a cocaine addict. He's going to lose the election. I think he already has by alienating a large percentage of the African American vote. But nonetheless, what do you do when a person has a cognitive impairment and yet, because of an unforeseen series of circumstances, the rise of Bernie Sanders again, nobody thought he'd be a threat again. You bring in Michael Bloomberg to save. Michael Bloomberg is a billion-dollar dud. And then you got who left, Beto or Kamala or Cory Booker or Buttigieg. So everybody said, get them all out of the race immediately, and we'll use Biden, and he'll be sort of a vessel. But the problem with that is you didn't, and then the COVID thing was very fortunate because it was a virtual campaign, and he's been in his basement for 9. But what do you do now? Do you put Joe Biden out in a debate? And you risk him saying some things that are pretty crazy like he did yesterday. One time he was out, and he was on the teleprompter. And he said, 100 people have been killed. 100 years have been killed this year. Nobody knew what he was talking about. But if you don't put him in the debate, you've got a sort of a Clint Eastwood 2012 convention where Trump, he'll go out there and talk to an empty chair. If you put him out and say, you know what, Trump is a madman. The guy is out there, he scarfs down a Big Mac, and then he sleeps 4 hours, and he's all over the country. So we got to match him. You got to have tarmac rallies. You have to have unscripted interviews. You have to have press conferences. Well, you can't do that. And yet if you don't do that, he's just covering ground that you can't cover. And so, because of the nature of his candidacy, he hasn't condemned the violence at all until recently, and he contextualizes it. He says, well, the police did this and police did this, but looting's bad. But sort of. And the reason he can't is he made a devil's bargain, Faustian bargain, with the hard left of his party. And he said, they basically said to him, you're going to be the centrist prop that's going to get us elected. And in exchange for that, we're going to create a sense of chaos in these cities in the enabling of the blue state mayors and governors, and that sense of anarchy will be blamed on the chief executive. But in return for that, once you're president, you're going to have the New Green Deal, the AOC Sanders ticket. And it was sort of blackmailing all of us. Because when Biden had said earlier, well, the violence will stop when I'm president, I think it would, because I think all these people said, we'll stop now because he's going to give us this agenda. So he can't criticize them, and yet he has to criticize them. And now people are getting angry, and it's a negative for him, and yet to do that breaks this unspoken bargain with BLM. And so he's got himself into a series of paradoxes. He's a prisoner of paradox. And I don't know how he squares that circle, but it'll be interesting to see. There's also a lot of known unknowns. I didn't think that in October the Democrats, after all the stuff that came out about Donald Trump, I didn't know they had a 10-year Access Hollywood to jump out on him right before the debate. Did you? Hours before the debate? The only miscalculation was that most people would have gone into a fetal position and said, oh my gosh. Trump got up and smiled and said, I'll have a good debate. And he got Steve Bannon. They brought in all of Bill's former liaisons, and they paraded him right in front of Hillary, and she kept looking like this. So, but that kind of thing. I think George Bush would have won the popular vote in 2000 had they not sprung his DUI he never told anybody about 48 hours before the election, made him look duplicitous. So that can happen. There can be a very embarrassing something about either candidate. Or China, who I think does not want Donald Trump, it could go in and send a missile over Taiwan, or bump into a Japanese ship, or do something with Australia. Very easy. Or Putin, we don't know where he is at any one time. He could do something in Belarus. And that's happened before. And so there's known, we'll call them known unknowns, and they'll be a predicator. And that's a neutral thing. That's not going to help either candidate. It will eventually. I think there's also something that we've talked about, and that is a stealth voter. I have a feeling, it's just my impression, that most of you will probably vote for Trump. But I also have a certainty that you're not going to be very vocal about it. In fact, I will bet you that in your circle of friends that when you were asked, you either lied or you were quiet. Because you know that it's not worth the social opprobrium, that people are going to demonize you, that you're worried. When you get a text and said, will you answer a poll or a phone call, you think, I'm not going to answer that. Knowing what Silicon Valley does with data, I might be on some list. So there is a 2 to 3 to 4%, people argue about it, stealth Trump vote. And I think the Democrats know that very well. And they, if you talk to some of their handlers, they will say, if we're down in our polls 2% in Michigan, then Trump's going to win. If Trump's down 2, he's going to win. We have to have him down 3 to 4 to 5. That's an issue. This is our first, if you notice, this is our first virtual election we've ever had. It's the first virtual candidate in Joe Biden, first virtual campaign. I've never seen anything like it. He hasn't campaigned at all. Nobody knows what he's for other than he says he's for the agenda. And even the DNC, did you know they never mentioned the agenda? Because they didn't want you to know what it was. You don't want to tear down the wall. Nobody wants a wealth tax. Nobody wants 40% income tax. Nobody wants to ban coal or ban natural gas or fracking or horizontal drilling. Medicare for everybody, free health care for illegal aliens. That's an issue that never polls 50% on any one of those items. And so it's kind of virtual. We don't hear about that. And they were very fortunate, they being the Democrats, that this lockdown came because it was tailor-made for Joe Biden. And all he had to do was let Trump take the blame, both as the commander-in-chief, as I mentioned, and then Trump's tweets. It was a very good strategy. We didn't even know who Biden was. We never saw him. When we saw him, it was a disaster, so we saw him even less the next time. And we never knew what the agenda was, and he was 8-9 points ahead. The only problem, as I said earlier, is that eventually you have to have a real campaign. It can be the last day, but at some point, the American people want to see what he's for and who he is and does he still exist. And that hurt Trump, that virtual campaign. And where we are now, as far as a virtual campaign, there's two items that are, I think, will help adjudicate the election. And that is whether we will have debates or not. Nancy Pelosi suddenly agreed with Tom Friedman, we won't. And Joe Biden, I think, said at one point, yes, we're going to have debates, but we're going to have fact checkers. That's sort of like the Candy Crawley, remember that, with Mitt Romney? She's going to be the moderator and say, stop, Mr. Trump, that's a lie. And Joe, that was pretty much true, but keep it up a little bit. Clean it up. So that could be that. But the most important thing is it's going to be a mail-in ballot election. If it's an absentee, nobody cares. It won't affect it either way with normal absentees. But if polls in some of these states are not going to be open at all. And the states, remember, under the Constitution, control the method in which the election is conducted. That's going to be a big problem. I'm speaking to somebody in the 21st Congressional District in California when our three-term incumbent, David Baldeo, won by 53% on Election Day. And nearing Christmas, 30 days later, he lost by 600 votes. By something we call in California third-party voting or third-party vote-gathering, or you know it better in the colloquial is vote harvesting, where state agencies get names, sometimes a name In some cases in California, if I'm Victor Hansen, I go to the DMV and I say I'm Victor D. Hansen. I go to the state disability, I get a ballot, I say I'm V.D. Hansen. Another one, I'm saying I'm Vic Hansen, and all the ballots come to the same address. Somebody shows up because it's public knowledge and says, here's your registration forms, give them to me. I'll fill them out, I'll take them and register, and I'll be back in a week with the ballot. The ballots will arrive, I'll be back to pick them up. And that was very effective. And the Republicans had no idea it was coming because they didn't do it in the primaries. And so it was very effective. And California has 7 out of 53 congressional seats that are Republican. It destroyed the Republican Party and the Congress in California. And it has super majorities in both legislatures, and it doesn't have one national, statewide, I should say, candidate, office holder that's Republican. So it was very effective. And that could be an important criterion. The most important, though, is what makes this different from the 1960s election. 68, you saw that the Democratic convention in Chicago, Mayor Daley, remember that, some of us, and there was all this turmoil. But what was different was the Democratic mayors of those cities tried to keep order. They sent the police out. They condemned the violence. We've never seen a situation in my lifetime where the chief of police, in some cases, but surely the local district attorneys, the mayors, the state, the city council, are actively on the side of the people perpetuating the violence. And they're trying to excuse it, and they're trying to contextualize it in league with the New York Times, the Washington Post, PBS, NPR, ABC, NBC, CBS, MSNBC, CNN. It's a fusion, and it's got enormous influence. And we've never quite seen that before. Part of it is because of the hatred of Trump, but part of it is the Democratic Party is not the party that we used to remember. The party of the middle class now, the working class, if you look at all the statistics, you look at zip codes, red, blue, by income, it's the Republican Party. It's the party of people who make $45,000 to $200,000. There are wealthy people, of course, but the real big money in America now, it's not from real estate necessarily. It's not from mining or timber or agriculture or railroad. It's from high tech, finance, Wall Street, Silicon Valley, and it's all left wing. Go look at the Fortune 500 and look at the names on there and see what their political affiliations are, if you know them. It's predominantly left-wing. So the Democratic Party has a very strange alliance from the very wealthy and the very poor. The wealthy are always immune from the consequences of their own ideology. They have the power, the influence, and the hypocrisy to want to tear down borders, have no walls, and then have the biggest wall you can imagine around the state of Mark Zuckerberg. Or Nancy Pelosi can tell everybody, you better wear a mask, Trump is not wearing a mask, and sneak into a salon, as she did in San Francisco, without a mask, and have a secret, stealthy hairdo. Or Gavin Newsom can give us lectures about, you've got to shut down all the wineries. Of course, mine won't be shut down. And that's sort of part and parcel of this new progressive ideology, that our aims are so noble. And we want such perfect egalitarianism and equality that we are allowed to use any means necessary to achieve them, because when we get them, then we're going to be, you know, saints. But we might have to break a few eggs on the way up. And that allows a person to do some pretty terrible things. So what I'm getting at is that we have a Democratic Party that has metamorphosized into a party of huge amounts of wealth and influence. Silicon Valley, Hollywood, New York TV programming, the media, the universities, the foundation, the celebrity culture, professional sports. It's a conglomerate. It includes everybody from Mark Zuckerberg to Bill Gates to LeBron James. Think of it. And that very wealthy class, that influential celebrity group that's so popular in our culture, is dedicated, believe it or not, to radically changing not just America, but the structure of America so it can't revert back to America. Now, I want to finish by what do I mean? If Joe Biden were to win, and if he were to win, I think he would take the U.S. Senate. I don't think he'd take it by a lot. I think he'd have 51 or 52 Democrats. The first thing they'd do would be eliminate the filibuster. If they held the House and the President, all 15 Democratic candidates said they wanted to pack the Supreme Court. It's not in the Constitution, the number. It's been 9 since 1867, but they could have 15. They said 15. They could vote that through the Senate and the House, and Biden would sign it, and they would appoint 6 justices, and they could be confirmed without a filibuster by 51 people in the Senate. No problem. And I think that we'd see that. I think the Electoral College would be dead. We'd never see it again. You don't have, everybody says, well, it's in the Constitution. You have to amend it. Well, in a sane world, you do. But all you need is 270 votes of individual states who say, and we've already got, 230 of electoral votes in these states, these blue states, that said, whoever wins the national vote, our state pledges that our electors shall not vote on the state tally, but they'll reflect the national vote. And when you get to 270, you only need about half the states, and then the Electoral College is dead. And some of you are going to say, well, that's a compact between states. That's unconstitutional. Well, not if the Supreme Court is altered. The Supreme Court determines what's constitutional and not unconstitutional. If you read what they say, they're attacking the very structure of having 2 U.S. senators. Why does Wyoming, one senator represents 225,000? Poor little Victor, my senator, I have to share Kamala Harris and Dianne Feinstein with each one is 20 million. That's not fair. I think that we should make senators distributed like House representatives. So California should have, 30? And maybe Wyoming 0 or 1. And I think that if you look at the literature, people are already talking about that. So what I'm getting at is, and then I won't even get into immigration, because we have taken the distinction between a U.S. citizen and a resident. It used to be crystal clear. Residents had these rights, but they paled in comparison with citizens' rights. If you look at what they are now, there are basically 3 rights that a resident doesn't have, illegal or legal. A resident supposedly cannot vote in an election, but they can now vote, as they're doing in San Francisco, in Cambridge, in local school board election. And you know what's going to follow from that. They supposedly cannot hold office. We've had people appointed to positions in California that are offices that are not here legally, they're residents, but illegal residents. And they cannot get a U.S. passport. But I'm not sure that we really care when a resident comes in and out of the country without a passport anymore. And so what I'm getting at is that this election is not just about a Democrat taking power and then a Republican coming in and vice versa. This is not a Democratic versus a Republican. This is a progressive, radical, revolutionary effort to change the structure of a constitutional republic that was deliberately founded to protect the people, with the Bill of Rights, the amendments, protect the people from the mob. It wasn't an Athenian-style democracy. That's what the founders, they want that. They do not want the American Revolution. They do not like Jefferson or Washington or Madison. They want their statue. They like the French Revolution. And I'll end with that very eerie, and that sounds, well, this guy's hysterical. What are you saying? What were the 2 symbols in the last 2 demonstrations? A guillotine. They guillotined the president symbolically. And so I think this is the one time a person could say without bombast or exaggeration, this is one of the 4 or 5 most important elections in our history. Thank you very much. Any questions? I don't know if I spoke too long. Do we have time for questions? If anybody has a question, we have. I don't hear all that well, but go ahead. Did everybody hear the question? Could you comment on the African-American vote? Today, there was a poll that came out that suggested that 25% of the black vote would go to Donald Trump. That's important because he only got 8% in 2016. And it's a very important because this election is not going to be decided in my state. It's not going to be decided in Alabama. It's not going to be decided in New York. It's going to be decided here, Pennsylvania, Wisconsin, Minnesota, Arizona, Florida. And the way that this dynamic has shifted is these big cities, Cleveland, Pittsburgh, Detroit, Philadelphia, Milwaukee, Madison, Columbus, Cleveland, they are at odds with the suburbs, but especially rural areas, people like Hillsdale County. And the way it works is Obama was able to get 95% of the African-American vote up to 97% and get record registration and record turnout. The black vote in 2008, the turnout was higher than the white vote. But that's very important because each year since then, the number of voters who call themselves middle class in general and white in particular that vote Democratic has gone down. So the reliance on the black vote goes up for a Democrat. And most people think the threshold is about 12% to 13%, and with the Latino vote, somewhere between 35 and 40%. When a Republican gets to that level, there's not going to be enough minority. And that also suggests another thing, that if people are polling that way, there's not going to be enthusiasm in general to vote for Biden, and maybe they won't come out. But my point is that if that poll were accurate, and there have been others like it, then they don't have the nucleus or the calculus, I should say, or the analytics to balance the rural areas and the conservative areas of these purple states. And I think that's why they're paranoid, and I think that's why we hear Trump's a racist, Trump's a racist, Trump's a racist. And why is that black vote there? Why is somebody that the Bush family and the Romney family and the McCain family is a racist getting three times higher black support than any of those candidates? There has to be a reason. And one, of course, was the record. It was record black unemployment, 5.4. Never have seen anything like it. Trump took whatever your views are on sentencing and drug reductions for drug offenses, he took, and pardons, he took the initiative. When you looked at the RNC convention, I never saw anything like it. I thought, isn't somebody going to say we need more millionaires, like George Bush said, George H.W.? Isn't somebody going to say the whole election will hinge on the capital gains tax? No. They had all these middle-class people up there that had these stories. And if you looked at it analytically, he turned the Republican Party into a class party. So he was saying that we are the worker, nationalist, populist, working people's party, and we don't have the celebrities. We don't have the Silicon Valley grandees like the DNC. They had all these movie stars. And the effect of that was to say to people that of all different races, your class ties are more solidifying than your racial differences. And that affected a lot of African Americans. And I think the looting has had an adverse effect on Joe Biden in the minority community. So what I'm getting at is I think that's very important. And you can, I know it's important, and you know it's important, because you're going to hear in the next 3 weeks that Donald Trump is a Klansman, he's a racist, he's whore, and they're going to try to do anything they can to get that vote away. Yes? Yeah, I think that, put it this way, that rise in the stock market in an election has not always been an absolute indicator who's going to win, but it has been a pretty accurate indicator of what people thought the economy would be like after the next president was elected. And this rise in the stock market, what I'm getting at, there'll be people, if we were to go to Goldman Sachs and poll 1,000 Goldman, I think the majority were going to vote for Biden. If we were going to poll them and say, what's your stock strategy from now until November, they would adjudicate it based on Trump. In other words, they'll tell everybody that I think they're voting against Trump, but hoping he wins, is what I'm getting at. Yes. Well, everybody hear the question? That under the Constitution, as I mentioned earlier, the founders were very worried. They were classical scholars. They had read Thucydides. They had read Plato. They knew who executed Socrates. It was the democracy. So, and they looked at the Roman tripartite model of judiciary, executive, legislative, checks and balances, and they liked it. And then that tradition had been prominent with Montesquieu and in the French Enlightenment. But nevertheless, what I'm getting at is that they put, as you pointed out, into the Constitution checks on popular frenzies. One of them was they let states predicate who could vote. They had a property qualification in most states. That was done with. The senators were supposed to be selected by the legislature, not the people. That was overturned, I think, in 1916 or 415. Was it on their progressive agenda? And that's gone. And you suggested maybe we should go back to, but the trajectory of all democratic experiments are, and this is not my idea, Plato said, if I can be so crass, he said, he asked Socrates say at one point in a famous passage, "Well, Gorgias, your democracy is going to let these people vote, and when do the dogs and the donkeys vote?" And he was being cruel and cynical, but what he meant was the logic of egalitarianism has no end. And so when I mention, you say you're worried that we now popularly elect senators, I'm worried that they're going to make, at best, senators proportioned on the population of the state. And worse, they're going to just take them away and not even give them one. And so we're moving in that direction. And if you look at a lot of things in the Constitution, they are no longer there. Impeachment now no longer means high crimes and misdemeanors or bribery and treason. I don't know about you, but I've never heard of anybody arrested, pulled over by a highway patrolman and said, "You're guilty of abuse of power and obstructing the Congress." That's what he was impeached on. It wasn't even a crime. But my point is, impeachment now is just what Madison said in the Federalist Papers, it's fatal. That the out party will try to, when they get a hold of a majority in the House, they will impeach the president for political reason. And he outlined exactly what happened in 2019 and 20. So yeah, you got a really good point. Yes, Gary. Yeah, in the old days, the guy who raised the most money often won, although I think it was John Conley had, I don't know how, he had one delegate in the nomination. He spent millions of dollars. Look at Michael Bloomberg, $1 billion, and what did it get him? But that old way of you hire all of these consultants, you come in, you have these 60-second TV ads, that has been changed, and that's because we have sophisticated data and Silicon Valley. I'll give you an example of what I mean. I won't mention any names, but I was seated in September of 2016 at a dinner, and one of the most renowned political figures in our history was there with another very famous person from Silicon Valley, and that person turned to me and said, "Shame on you for voting for Donald Trump. He has no idea how to run a campaign. He's going to lose. He doesn't understand data. Hillary's got Robbie Mook running his campaign. He's got the tech wizards. They're young. They're hip. They got Facebook." And this other person was listening to this. And I saw him scowl. And so this very renowned gentleman turned to him and said, "What are you scowling at. He said, you know where Hillary is going to be? She's going to be in Georgia and Arizona on a Don Quixote quest to get a landslide mandate. She's never going to take those states. And we are the proverbial fox in the hen house, and we have data on every single person who did not vote in the 2008 or 2012 election. There's 4 to 6 million of them. And we're going to beat the Romney. I thought, wow, he's Silicon Valley. What's he mean by we? But I was listening. He said, we're going to get 4 to 6 million. You can call him what you want, he said to this gentleman. Call him a Perot voter. Call him a Reagan Democrat. Call him a deplorable. I don't care. But we're going to get them out. They've checked out. And we're going to get them out with China. We're going to get them back out with border. We're going to get them back out with reindustrializing the West. No more Afghanistan. He went through the hole. And this guy got kind of angry. And he said, how would you know? I won't say his name because you'd all recognize it. He said, because I designed the system. And I've got the most sophisticated people in Silicon Valley, and they've contacted now 5 times those 4 to 6 million people. And you wait to election day. And I turned to him and I said, you're going to win Michigan? He said, the question's not whether they're going to win Michigan, it's whether we're going to win Minnesota. And as you know, they came within 2 points of winning it. So that's what the election is about now. It's targeting people with electronic selectivity and repeated messaging and finding which many little groups this appeals to. And the idea of Trump, the buffoon and sloppy, belies the fact that he actually has very good as Biden's analytics from Silicon Valley. Any other questions? Right here. I don't know the answer to that. The question was, why wasn't Candace Owens invited to speak at the Republican? I think maybe that her former partnership with Charlie Kirk, I don't know what happened, but that dissipated. But I don't think it hurt her because she's being lauded to the skies when you see these polls of African American and the Blacksit, she said. So she was kind of the architect of that. But I don't know the inner politics of that. She's a very effective spokeswoman for the Republican Party, and I have a feeling she's going to play a prominent role in the campaign. Well, in the old days, a Republican would have said this when we had the lockdown, the COVID, the unemployment. He said, listen, damn it, we already are running a $1 trillion deficit. I would have said that. We're already running a $1 trillion deficit. Now we're up to $26 trillion almost. We're broke. And we're going to have, what are we going to do, have zero interest for the rest of our lives to service that debt? That's taking money from people that have passbook accounts that work their whole life. They've got $100,000, and they lose money because inflation eats it up, and they get 0 or 1% with. That's intolerable. Not Trump. This guy hates banks. He's declared bankrupt. His idea is somebody comes to him and says, let's inflate the economy. Let's give people as much staying home to get through it. We'll get 4 million, and then we'll get the economy roaring, and we'll have an Arthur Laffer, and we'll pay it all back, and then we'll get tough and cut. I don't think that's going to happen. But that was a Republican who bought that, and I will concede that it kept the economy liquid. And so even though we've had a terrible recession, we haven't had a recession. In my hometown, the biggest joke is you talk to people, and they said, I'll say, you know, Amazon has signs hiring. They have all these things. Yeah, but I don't want to take a pay cut. They're making as much staying home, but that has greased the economy, and it's added $4 trillion to the debt. And I think Trump, he's not, I think people who have talked to him will tell you that he said the money is free for now. So if you actually look at the percentage of the budget that has to service this huge debt, once interest rates went to 1 or 2%, it didn't really go up much as a percentage of the federal budget compared to where we had a much smaller national debt, but we were paying 7 and 8 on T-bills or even 10. So we know what's coming. We're either going to have to debase the currency, or we're going to have a terrible recession to address it and run surpluses, or we're going to have quantitative easing and increase the money supply, or we're going to have rampant inflation. It's going to be one of those. Yes? I have nothing to tell you because I'm a twin brother of somebody who voted for Bernie Sanders. So obviously I failed in that category. And then I will go a step further in saying that of my immediate siblings, I'm the black sheep pariah. I mean, they are much more persuasive with them than me. But all I try to say, if that's any help, that you could tell her that this isn't about Trump's personality. This is not about George Bush versus Al Gore. It's not even Barack Obama versus John McCain. This is about a radical hijacking of the Democratic Party. And this is telling people that we are going to take the First Amendment, as you know, and it's not going to apply on campuses. We're going to take the Second Amendment as the founders envisioned. It's not going to apply anymore. The Supreme Court is not going to look the same. That statue in your park is going to be gone. That 1776 date in your mind is going to be Orwellian erased. It's going to be 1619. We are going to change the statues. We're going to change that movie. You think you want to watch Turner classic movies and see Gone with the Wind? It's not going to be there when we get in there. This is an effort to systematically, in a Trotskyite fashion, erase our collective memory and our values and replace it with a totalitarian, radical French revolutionary Jacobin model. And I have never seen anything like it, and I lived through the 60s. Do we have one more in the finisher? Any final? Yes, right there. So what is behind the Antifa BLM model? Well, we know the short term. I mean, I'm trying to be fair to them. I don't think they would have been as effective or frenzied had we not had the fear of the virus, 90 days of lockdown, recession. Let's add in $1.5 trillion in student loans for degrees that were pretty much worthless and end up. A lot of these people are looking at $80,000 at 66% while they work as a barista with a sociology or environmental studies degree. So they're angry. They're angry because if you look at home ownership, the age of marriage, the age of childbearing, the age of buying a first home, it's all wacko. So today's pajama boy in that commercial or Life of Julia is a ward of the state. These are people who, if they do get married, they get married in their 30s. If they do have a child, it's one child when they're 40. When they do buy a home, it's the, you know, it's a little cottage that costs $1,000 a square foot in San Francisco or something. So they're not happy, and I don't blame them for that reason. That being said, what do they, they've been, I don't, I think this didn't happen right now. A lot of people at Hillsdale especially have been warning what has been going on K through 12 and what's been going on to college. So I was a professor and I'm an academic. I can tell you that they have been indoctrinating people and saying the corporation, your religion, your community are all biased, so we're going to be biased to balance them. And we're going to turn you out as a woke, deductive thinker. And we're not. And these people are very arrogant and they're very ignorant. When they go and tear down a statue named Lee and they congratulate themselves, and it's not Robert E. Lee, it's J.C. Lee of World War II, who was a logistician, you know how stupid they are. Or they try to deface Frederick Douglass statue, or they say they're anti-fascist and they attack the World War II monument for people who destroyed fascism. So they're very ignorant, they're very arrogant, they're very young, and they're very angry, and they're jealous and envious, and they're confused. But most important, you remember that line in Dirty Harry when Dirty Harry says, the Zodiac's going to kill again, and that kind of bureaucratic ignoramus that's his boss says, how do you know that, Harry? And he said, because he likes it. And they like it. They like going out there. They're getting paid with this support, and they know that nothing's going to happen to them. If one of them, two of them, three of them, four of them find out they have a federal felony warrant out for their arrest, if the police decide to crack down, have you seen these YouTubes when they crack down? They scream in this high nasal voice. And then you look at them, and it's the Washington Post ran a photo op, a chic Vogue-like photo op, a photojournalist story on them, and they had eight of them posing. They were like this. Here is my green bike helmet and my pads. Here's my leaf blower to blow away tear gas. Oh, here's my umbrella to stop tear gas capsules. And it was all sort of like the glorification of the good-looking Sarnoff brother, the Boston Marathon that Vogue did. And so this is kind of a chic thing for these young kids. They think they look, and what are they doing when they're going in and looting? They're taking selfies of themselves. They're posting things on the internet. They don't think, well, when I get arrested, I better damn well have the Fifth Amendment. I better have habeas corpus. I better have a right to a speedy trial. I better have a right to counsel. They don't think that they're destroying that. They don't think, well, I have a gun. That guy, one of the people, they have guns. They say, well, I have a right to carry a Second Amendment. They don't think that they're destroying the very system what they're going to be in need of when they're in extremists. So they're angry, young, confused people who have been indoctrinated for years, and they feel there's no consequences for destroying the system. And they're not even aware that the system that they're destroying that has been very good to them. So they're ingrates and ungrateful. And the only thing you can do to snap them out of their mesmerized hypnosis is to eventually, in a very selective, careful way, make them arrest them when they break the law and charge them with federal, not local crimes, incarcerate them, put it on their record, and then get federal troops to come in when it's wise and sober. And once you start doing that, it will dissipate. But they're not heroic people. They're not Che Guevara. Not that I like the guy, but at least he went into Bolivia with his machine gun and fought it out before they killed him. These people are not going into rural Utah and saying, you know what, I got to get into Red Hillsdale County. I'm going to get my guys in there, and we're going to storm Jonesville. Then we're going to go to Jackson. Then we're going to take Hillsdale and fight it out with those roots. They're not going to do that. Thank you.